On the last episode of the Video Archives podcast, Roger and Quentin were filled with rage.
Showing me this film in the year 2022 is akin to throwing gasoline on fire. And you knew that.
Experience the magic of a real change in the loved one.
Billed as the motion picture with something to offend everybody. The movie doesn't have almost anything to offend anybody now anymore.
And shed a tear during Cry For Me, Billy.
But there's a powerful tag at the end that just makes it a cynical, fucked up 70s Western.
And now we bring you the after show, your backstage pass to exclusive content, answers to your burning questions, and even more film discussions. I'm your reporter on a rampage for a good reason, Gala Avery. My VHS tape for Cry For Me, Billy finally arrived. I'm so glad I was actually able to watch this movie in English. Although there isn't a ton of dialogue in the film, it really made all the difference in my understanding of the movie. Quentin and Roger invited me back to the store to discuss my opinions on the film. This and more, all on today's episode of The After Show. Before we get into the further discussion on Cry For Me, Billy, let's take a listen to some outtakes from the episode. Rage was George C. Scott's directorial debut. Quentin theorized about how Scott came across Rage, along with a personal story from Roger about how stuff like Quentin's theory actually happens in Hollywood.
Even the whole idea about them doing the movie, I'm positive that it's a situation where it's either one of two situations. Warner Brothers came up with this script and offered to George C. Scott, hey, we got a great picture for you. And he goes, okay, well, I'll do it if you let me direct it. Or it's a thing where George C. Scott went to Warner Brothers and goes, I want to direct something. What do you got?
Yeah, what do you got?
And then like they gave him like five scripts. Well, here are five that if you did it, we'd do it. And he like read all five and got ready to go, yeah, I'll do this.
Yeah.
And actually both answers would be good answers. I kind of like the second one better.
Yeah.
I can actually see him reading five scripts, all right, you know, that they say, well, if you do this one, we'll do it. And then him really, yeah, okay, I'll do Rage. That'll be good.
I've actually had that happen to me at Warner Brothers.
Oh.
Where after killing Zoe, Lorenzo de Bonaventura called me in and he's like, okay, we want to make a movie with you. These are the scripts we have. And he opened up his cabinet and there were a bunch of scripts. He said, I'm just going to read titles and you tell me which one sounds good to you. And I'll send you home with that script.
Roger's mystery script he chose? The answer to that would be Sandman, which is the project that started his and Neil Gaiman's longtime friendship. One of the aspects of a film that Quentin and Roger never failed to miss is the architecture of a movie. When it came to Rage, the duo loved the 60s architecture and, as Roger puts it, the way that modernism is invading the simplicity of the plains.
It's also really striking to look at all of this kind of 60s modernist architecture plopped into the middle of the desert.
Oh, no, that's a really neat aspect about the film, the fact that it takes place in Wyoming and that all the places, he never goes to town because every place is a big structure out in New fucking Mexico or something.
As if they're going to build a city around these buildings someday.
Yeah.
But they just plop this thing. And so people will be in some kind of crazy modernist office building and then they turn and you're looking out and there's nothing outside.
Well, I mean, it's like, I think it's supposed to take place in Wyoming, but it sure seems like it's taking place in New Mexico because New Mexico is where they have all those places out in the middle of the desert, you know, big hotels with nothing around it.
Yeah.
Space age labs with nothing around it.
Yeah, that's exactly. And so it has like that strange, stark quality as well of the space age or the modernism invading the kind of simplicity of the plains.
Although I theorized briefly in the main episode that Rage was shot in California, the movie was actually shot entirely in Arizona, mainly in Benson and Tucson. Rage brought out the conspiracy theorist in Roger. And to be honest, it brought out the conspiracy theorist in me as well. One theory brought up in the main episode is the strange handshake between Martin Sheen and Richard Basehart. The handshake is known as the Lion's Paw Grip. The Lion's Paw is the grip of the Master of the Third Degree Freemason. You can also see this handshake being performed in another film this week. Where is it? Look closely in the scene in The Loved One in the Car Park. You'll see Sir Ambrose and Sir Lindsay perform the exact same handshake with each other. Roger brings up another theory that he had when it came to Rage. What happened to his wife?
And also, I was thinking about his wife. Mm-hmm. You know, this military base is nearby and they're testing shit all the time. And we know that his wife died before the movie takes place. Mm-hmm. We know that he's lost his wife and that he's in some ways, he and his son are, you know, they've bonded because of it, but there's obviously a sense of melancholy among, you know, at the beginning of the film. And I started thinking about it. It's like, man, they're responsible for his wife's death also, probably. That's not in the movie.
You guys just keep...
But think about it,
yanking
Quentin.
Out chapters written in invisible ink, all right?
Well, the pages that were pulled.
Speaking of conspiracy theories, this one comes straight from the history books. Rage was actually inspired by an event known as the Sheep Kill Incident. In March 1968, around 6,000 sheep died 30 miles away from Dugway's testing sites. When examined, it was found the sheep were poisoned with organophosphate chemicals. Although the Army claimed that this poisoning was due to the local use of organophosphate pesticides, it was later revealed the sheep had died due to the conducted tests of a nerve agent chemical weapon called VX nerve gas that was sprayed from a jet aircraft. The Army did not admit fault for this event until 1998. The Loved One was one of the movies that Roger had wanted to talk about since the beginning of the Video Archives podcast. So much so that he even brought it up a few episodes ago in one of our pre-show talks. Let's listen now as he gives Quentin a clue as to why he really wanted to discuss it on our episode.
I can't wait for us to watch The Loved One for so many reasons, not the least of which
is Rod Steiger.
Rod Steiger and every moment on screen. And in fact, it's his moment on screen that is even the other stuff that I want to talk about that has nothing. It has one of the greatest. I think we've talked about this. One of the what I feel is the greatest real change of all time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You mentioned that.
And we'll talk about it on the day. But it's of course, a Rod Steiger scene because every scene that he's in is magnificent in that way. And yeah, I would say that it's right up there with every great performance that he's done.
When I watched The Loved One at home, my dad couldn't help but join me on the couch. Luckily for him, he showed up just at the right time. The infamous Joy Boy sequence was just about to play. Roger talks about the quality of the DVD transfer and how the reel change looked different on VHS, DVD, and Laserdisc.
I'm going to break with orthodoxy a little bit here. I watched the movie again on DVD. I have a DVD copy of the film and, with Gala. And we had watched it together. And I have to say, the DVD like looked like Dr. Strangelove. It was crisp, blacks and whites. The tape that we watched was more, you described it as silver and ash.
Yeah, almost.
It was like almost fuzzy and a little muddy.
It was very, it
definitely
was,
different elements.
It was like, it wasn't black and white. It was gray and darker gray.
So the DVD though, they've tried to smooth out the reel change.
Oh, of course they did.
There's no reel change there. If you look carefully, and I studied it carefully as we rewatched it again, we went back and again and again and again, you can actually still see a very small edit. A tiniest edit is there. There's a little tiny jump.
Yeah, but they're trying to smooth it out.
But they're doing their best to smooth it out. Okay, the Laserdisc. Now, Laserdisc has DVD quality.
Yeah.
And the Laserdisc still has that reel change, and it has a better transfer than the VHS. And so I would say that I would advocate right now the Laserdisc above the DVD, the Blu-ray, or the VHS.
VHS, okay.
Right now, I'd say Laserdisc is the way to go with this film.
Okay.
And for that, you have to go to the Roger Avery-owned part of Video Archives.
Yes, you do.
Which is the Laserdisc section. I win! No, anyhow.
Okay, so this reel change is magical. My dad and I have discussed this reel change extensively, as it's one of the most important reel changes in all of cinema. However, there's one aspect of the reel change that Roger and I did not discuss on the main episode, which is my new theory about the meaning of this reel change. Roger pointed out that the reel change happens when Joy Boy's dream turns into a nightmare, but that's not the only thing that occurs during the reel change. What's the subject on screen during it? Is it Mr. Joy Boy? No. It's the moment that they cut to Amy Thanatogenes and her reaction to her realization of who Mr. Joy Boy truly is. This is when her dream has become a nightmare. And this is the true magic of a reel change. As we talked about on the main episode, there are so many amazing cameos this week. Roger and Quentin talked about the eclectic supporting cast of The Loved One, including a waiter and a very well-placed alien in the background.
Yeah, even that it's populated by the actors of that time.
Yeah.
Entirely.
Oh, yeah. No, it's like, well, forget about dumb idiots watching the movie now who don't know who fucking Tab Hunter is and don't know who Liberace is and don't get the joke that Liberace's doing. Okay, forget about those fucking idiots. All right. I'm talking about watching the movie and responding to it as a movie as it moves from scene to scene to scene. You know, it's so completely connected in its time period. The fact that, like, I mean, most people will not even have a connection to who Robert Morris is, but people in the 60s absolutely did. Yeah. Jonathan Winters might have to be explained to some people about who the fuck he is, where nobody had to explain who he was in this time period in the 60s. He was considered, I think, wrongly a genius, all right? And I think this movie shows his lack of that quality, all right, in this role. If I was going to not choose Richard Basehart... if I was not going to choose Harry Dean Stanton, and then if I was not going to choose Martin Sheen, I would choose Liberace.
Yeah, and actually, like, that's the thing about the loved one.
There's so many supporting actors.
There are so many amazing supporting actors. I mean, frankly, Paul Williams, I love. Mm-hmm. Liberace, I love. Roddy McDowell, I love. I mean, I could, like...
if Roddy McDowell had a bigger part, he could have won Best Supporting
Actor.
Did you
catch Jamie Farr in the movie?
I mentioned it when we watched it.
Oh, you did? Okay, good.
Don't you remember me mentioning it?
I don't remember half of what happened.
No, it's like the waiter comes by. Hey, that's fucking Jamie Farr.
Yeah, Jamie Farr, yeah. And I don't even think he's credited in the film.
Well, it's not even a role.
Yeah.
He's an extra.
It's an extra. It's a glorified extra.
It's fucking Klinger. Yeah. Okay, you know that
at the studio.
You know what that alien is
from Star Trek?
I thought it was the alien from Star Trek. No, it's the David McCullum six finger.
Oh my god,
alien.
that's the Outer Limits.
Yeah, it's
the six finger. Right,
but
right.
It's the actual mask from that episode.
The ultimate evolution of man.
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually interesting that it's the ultimate evolution of man.
It is. No, it's not random.
Behind John Gielgud, almost on his shoulder.
Yeah, and talk about a reference to something ripped from the headlines. I mean, I'm sure that Outer Limits episode was maybe only a year earlier.
Yeah.
But if you watch Outer Limits, you're going to fucking recognize it.
As you guys know from some of the other episodes, we don't always talk about all of the movies we watch. As a special treat, Quentin makes a connection to a movie that we almost talked about on the show.
Well, with a chasm drop.
The whole setup of that joke and then everything, that was sort of... Now, you know who else Antoinette Comer is, don't you? She's the... you watched...
She's your mother, Gala. Yeah.
You watched Death Stalk, didn't you?
Yes.
She's wife.
She's
Vince Edwards' wife in Death Stalk.
Oh my gosh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Oh my gosh.
She's also in another really funny movie that Alan Arkin directed called, and she's playing a nut in that movie as well, Fire Sale.
Fire Sale.
So Fire Sale. It's with Alan Arkin and Rob Reiner, and Alan Arkin directed. It's a pretty funny movie.
Death Stalk, directed by Robert Day, is available on YouTube to watch. Although I like the movie, I actually much prefer the pulp novel it's based on by Thomas Chastain. Don't tell anyone, but I actually cried reading the book. Yeah, it's just that good. During our awards ceremony, you may have heard me mention cinematographer Haskell Wexler painting the shadows. Want to know what I was talking about? Roger tells us the story behind this comment.
You know, there's a moment that Haskell Wexler describes when he was shooting a scene where, because of the schedule, it ended up on high noon. Mm-hmm. And DPs in black and white never liked to shoot in high noon because of the...
Well, no DP likes to shoot when the sun is directly above shooting down.
But he
like
said,
they don't let you shoot.
He said, you know, black and white is much more difficult to shoot than color. Color gives you instant contrast and depth in between mm-hmm. things. But black and white, you really have to, you know, plan those contrasts. And you have to plan the light in that way. And it's much more difficult. And he describes this one moment at Whispering Glades where and they're in the Garden of Homer or mm-hmm. wherever Francis Hensley is going to be laid to rest. He said, it was just so bright that I had the art department paint long shadows onto the lawn mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. of the thing to look like there were long shadows there.
Yeah.
But if you look at the actors, they're just projecting shadows straight down.
Yeah.
they don't have long shadows.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what you can do with black and white. You can literally paint your shadows.
Well, you know where you learned that trick from? You learned that trick from Joseph von Sternberg.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because von Sternberg, back when you were shooting black and white, and if he wanted to, rather than just keep moving in a light to light this up, he just walk around with a like an exterminator has their extermination junk. All right, he had a can of white paint. All right, and we just spray white paint on little different corners to light them up.
There is no doubt about it. Rod Steiger is an amazing actor. Quentin shares the impact that Mr. Joy Boy has had on other actors.
I do want to bring up one thing is, so this weekend I was on a Kung Fu movie kick. So I was watching a bunch of 70s Kung Fu movies. And I watched this, a Bruce Lee movie called Fist of Bruce Lee, directed by Bruce Lee, no less. So Lo Lee's in it and everything. But there's this character that is the lawyer of the big mob guy. The big triad fellow. He's the lawyer of the triad fellow, but he's got this kind of, like Joy Boy, he's got a sick obsession with the a mobster's daughter. And the lawyer is sweating all the time. He's patting his face with a handkerchief. And I'm watching it, I'm like, he's basing his performance off of Rod Steiger as Joy Boy.
Kind of prissy.
There's nothing about the scripts that are similar, other than the fact that he's also obsessed with this other woman. But it's obviously that actor has seen The Loved One and is doing his version of Joy Boy. And so, like, you know, to only have seen this movie after all this time on Friday and then Sunday to watch a martial art movie from the 70s, Bruce Lee directed. Martial art movies from the 70s, and to see a Joy Boy reference kind of blew me away.
Also, the scene where he first tells Miss Dinotogenous, Amy, that, like, oh, whenever I bring a loved one to you, I don't know, I something feels, I know that it has to be special, and that I, you know, like, mm-hmm. he's really talking to her like he's excited. What he's doing with his hands mm-hmm. in that moment as he's talking to her is some of the best acting. Like, what he does alone with just his hands mm-hmm. in a scene is incredible. It's just wonderful to watch.
One of Roger's favorite parts about The Loved One was John Gielgud, specifically the wonderful dialogue that he recited. Up next, Roger reenacts some of Gielgud's best moments.
Those were the days, you know. I only had to ask for something, and they went straight out and bought it. If I said real gold, then real gold it had to be. And then my favorite, which I always think about when I think about you because of how jet-lagged you were. These newfangled jets, abrupt transitions. I'm certain one loses all sense of time and proportion. Not like the good old days aboard the Queen Mary.
That was a great line.
So many great lines when he talks about
the good old days on the Queen Mary, aboard the Queen Mary.
When he talks about Hollywood, he's like, and the United States, because this movie really is kind of about how the English come to Hollywood to die.
You know,
and one could say there's almost a, you know, come to Hollywood to die subgenre, the plays. But his description of America and especially Hollywood, they talk entirely for their own pleasure and they don't expect you to listen. It's the secret of social ease in this country.
There are so many Hollywood inside jokes in The Loved One, so much so that this next one was completely lost on me. Thankfully, Quentin is here to let us know the true identity of Dusty Rhodes and what the actual joke surrounding his character is.
All right. I mean, you know, David Hemmings is the star of his next movie. How come David Hemmings isn't playing, you know, the character? And they even make a joke about the whole running joke in the first half of the movie is the Dusty Rhodes character is supposed to be doing a British accent and he's terrible at it. You know, and they're all just pumping themselves. Ah, he's fantastic. Ah, she's tea and crumpets. It's ready to go, dear boy. Yeah. Ready to go.
You think you can do that all accent, right. Dusty? Well, I think if I snuck up on it, I might be able to get it. And
Robert Morse isn't doing drastically better than Dusty Dusty Rhodes.
You line him up and I'll knock him down.
And by the way, Robert Easton, who plays Dusty Rhodes, is like the foremost in real life, is the foremost dialect coach.
Is he really?
In Hollywood for
that's
the last
the
few
joke,
years.
That's the joke then. That's the whole joke.
I don't think he was that much of a dialect coach in 1964, but but in the 70s and the 80s, he was that guy.
Before we get into the further discussion on Cry For Me, Billy, Quentin dishes out some extra information on director William Graham.
But we have to mention the terrific director, William Graham, directed the film.
Who I was completely, like, stupidly unaware of before this movie.
No, William A. Graham, he's a wonderful TV movie director, all right? He's done some really good TV movies. He was known as Billy Graham by, you know, most of the actors working with him. I've talked to many of these old-time actors, and whenever his name comes up, oh, Billy Graham, he was wonderful. So, you know, Michael Parks worked with him on one of his better TV movies, Escape from Bogan County.
Oh, right.
And, you know, he sang Billy Graham's praises. Bruce Dern used to sing Billy Graham's praises. Oh, Billy Graham was wonderful. And then in the early 80s, Billy Graham did another Western, another feature that starred Bruce Dern called Harry Tracy Desperado.
Oh, so Bruce Dern.
Shot out of Canada. So it's Bruce Dern, Helen Shaver, and Gordon Lightfoot. And if she hadn't have died, very possibly Dorothy Stratton would have played the Helen Shaver part in Harry Tracy Desperado.
Now, let's talk Cry For Me, Billy. If you haven't had a chance to watch it, be warned. I'm dishing out all the spoilers. Hello, everyone. I am so excited today to say that I am finally here to talk about Cry For Me, Billy with Roger and Quentin. Yay! I was able to watch it with English language on VHS. And let me tell you, the quality was so much better than the terrible VHS rip, the terrible German VHS rip that I'm so thankful, though, is on YouTube.
Das ist ein crappy Transfer.
It was a crappy Transfer. But I'm really glad because there are countless fans out there that are able to watch it in German. And that's right now the only way that people besides buying a VHS tape can watch it. So I'm hoping that by the time this comes out, there is more accessibility for this movie. But let's dig in. Okay, this movie totally changes when you actually watch it in the proper language. The eeriness of rolling into the town, the quietness of him like clopping along, it's so good. And right off the bat, we know that he's the good guy. He gives the Indians water. He shoots the man who's about to bash the Indian's head in with a hammer, but like doesn't kill the guy. He just like shoots his hand.
Wait a minute. The guy's a blacksmith. He's just actually ruined his entire fucking life by shooting him in the hand.
That guy gets his
That's why the end actually works is because he fucking ruined his Harry Dean Stanton actually says, okay, you now put the blacksmith out of business.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is that's a very realistic ending too, because it's not like some posse got him. It's not like the law caught up with him.
It's that
the guy who's ruined the ending.
The ending is maybe one of the best parts of the movie.
The ending's really good. But it's so funny though, because when he shoots him, it shows how good of a shot he is, because he shoots him in the hand, like where it hurts him the most. Like, he can't work anymore. His hand's messed up, but he's not dead.
Yeah. Well, so, he's also trying to shoot the hammer out of his hand. And so that, which.
Yeah. Like, but I think he's just a good enough shot that he actually means to shoot his hand.
Yeah.
I don't think he's trying to shoot the hammer out. I think it's like.
Well, also, he's such a, like, I don't know, California American looking, like almost surfer looking guy, like with that blonde hair. Like, in a realistic way, like, he looks like a saddle tramp.
Yeah. The movie cannot be divorced from the time that it was made. It's like around 71 is when it came out. I mean, there is an anti-establishment hippie aspect to it.
Yeah.
And both of them are supposed to be hippie, like free spirits.
Yeah. You know? And they definitely are.
Yeah, because so when he rolls in, you inherently are like, oh, this is my hero. You feel that.
Yeah, and you feel like he's a good guy. He's even going against, like, the United States Army, basically, at the time period, which is very a la Rage, which we talked about this week also. They're kind of both dealing with this same thing of going against big groups of people, as you say, because groups of people will do things the individual never will.
They're both responses to Vietnam, as Quentin was.
Yeah, you're right. And you're right. They both come from a similar attitude about America and America's institutions.
Yeah, a little bit of a transgressive reassessment of where we're at, you know, as a country at war.
Yeah. And he's so good that he even pays the men for the food when he gets to that cabin. And they've kind of like, they shit talk his woman. And they even say that they want to, like, rape her. And then he sends them off and he goes into the house and he's taking their food and he even leaves some money for the food. Like, that's how good of a guy even is.
But that actually makes sense, though, because you actually respected the guy. Hey, look, if you're not just robbers,
Or
yeah. Leave some money. $2 will do it.
Which we're claiming you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. If you're going to actually be all high and mighty and you're not just robbers, then that food is worth $2 unexpected on the table.
And he leaves it.
Yeah.
My only problem is he doesn't leave it on the table.
Okay.
He actually flips it onto the floor.
Yeah, I thought he left like one coin on the table and like one maybe coin he did. On the
maybe,
floor.
Maybe it just fell on the table off camera or something. Like I didn't see that.
No, but I think it's like, no, you're going to have to bend down to pick this shit up.
I'm going to make you, exactly. Get on your knees to get it.
And I love this movie is just filled. I mean, it's barely a story. It's these weird, you've set up the characters and it's just these strange vignettes that they find themselves in. And every one of them's a winner as far as I'm concerned. None of the vignettes didn't work.
Oh, I completely agree. And being able to like actually understand the dialogue and like what's going on, starting like when he rolls into town and he meets his friend who he... Harry Dean Stanton, who he ran out on.
Mm-hmm. They had something in the past that obviously things didn't go 100% between the two of them, but they were childhood friends.
And I love that game that they play with the guns.
That crazy ass game.
Watching it in the German dub, I had no clue what was going on. I was like,
to Germans, that's normal, probably. My grandfather.
I don't know if I would ever play that game, and I don't even know if the game makes much sense, but I can give you the benefit that I've never seen it before.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's the American version of what my grandfather, who was German, did, which was when they were in school, they would take a fencing sword. Your friend would take a fencing sword up to your face and slice it and do a cut. Mm-hmm. And the trick was if you had a straight scar or not, because if your scar wasn't straight, it meant you flinched. Mm-hmm. And a person who flinched, it was usually depicted as a kind of villain, a Nazi-ish villain.
I think that there's a little bit more of an aspect of like a tomahawk throw.
A tomahawk throw to...
Just like, putting a person up against a wall or and then doing a tomahawk throw and it boom, and then it falls on this side of the face and boom on that side of the face and boom right in between the arm and the body.
They're definitely trying to say whichever one of us can shoot closest to the other.
Well, that's what they're definitely doing.
And the one guy gets, like, Potts gets his, like, shirt and he's like, whoa, that's pretty close. But then Harry Dean Stanton, it's like the hairs on his cheek.
But I love that line that he does, though. He says, oh, it's like, where's the other bullets? And he said, I couldn't figure out where to put them.
Yeah.
Because he would have put them in him.
Yeah.
Because he was that close.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love how they set up just how good of a shot he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he is just that good. And so I love, like, that vignette is great. When he saves the Indians, that's a great part because it's like, it shows his humanity. I love when, Sochil Maria Potts steals the horse at the very beginning and kind of rides away.
By the way, that's hard to ride a horse bareback. To have your actress like galloping on a horse, holding onto the mane
of
the horse without a saddle. I mean, you've worked with horses.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know exactly what it's like to put an actor on a horse.
I'm sure the horse had they wouldn't do that with an actor.
Well, this also comes from a time period where actors were, frankly, better trained on horses.
I know that, but I'm sure the horse had, there's kind of like a piano wire kind of a bit.
To help hold it.
Bit and reins.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, that you can wrap up but they're not going to just, and a horse goes, the horse needs a bit in his mouth to put a rider on
it. Even with that. Sochil or Maria.
She's fantastic.
She is amazing. Like,
with
physically.
No dialogue, and she does such an amazing performance.
Yeah. She says Billy.
But you know what's amazing about that?
And just like that.
Is when she says Billy.
Yeah.
That's when you know she's in love.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true.
The moment, and they use that one line of dialogue to tell you everything you need to know, that she's no longer trying to escape from him. She now trusts him. Mm-hmm. They're together, and he loves her too. Mm-hmm. This movie was like really special, to be honest. I was so excited that I actually got to watch it because I sat down and I thought, oh, I've seen this before in German. I was like a little lukewarm on it. Mm-hmm. But then watching it in English, I was like, man, I really dig this. This is really great. The scene with him at the river with the snake where he's like playing
with the snake.
It's like such a quiet, tender moment where he's by himself and you see that he's like a sensitive man. Like he's not killing the snake. He's not throwing around. Even like kind of tries to go and he puts it back where it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I love that. And Maria Potts, she's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Exceedingly so. Like, especially on the transfer that I saw, she is like...
Yeah, she's stunning.
She's stunning. And she really is bearing it all. She is out there naked, barefoot, like getting rolled around.
Yeah.
That's she brings it.
And they're in like the high Sierra Nevadas or something. And so it's cold. It's rocky and she's barefoot. She's running around. I mean, it's like physically a challenging performance to do.
And it makes sense that they're married because especially that scene where he is chasing her and they roll around the ground together. Like his head is like up in her crotch. Mm-hmm. I don't think that like if you were not married or like not intimate with each other, that you could have that level of like wrestling on the ground. Like she's really punching him and he's really like trying to grab her.
They certainly found intimacy. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's for sure. You know, I'm really happy this movie is available to Germans in German language and that they can enjoy it in German. But one of the reasons to watch this movie is for the amazing vernacular of the dialogue, the period, which feels so authentic.
Yeah, no, it's like, I like the way the film is directed. I like the way the story goes. And I love the cynicism, the 70s cynicism of the ending. But what makes this a rewatchable kind of movie and what puts it in a special place other than just the genre, the genre tropes that I like, is, you know, that true grit type of cowboy speak. It almost seems like a Western American version of Elizabethan.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really, honestly, the dialogue is really, the script itself is really tight. As Quentin was talking about earlier, how it wraps around that, spoiler alert, I guess, in the end, he's killed by the blacksmith.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is the person that he has basically ruined his life. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, like, he's told not to roll back into town, and he does roll back into town, mm-hmm. and that's where he meets his end by the person that, like, he's wronged. And he gets shot in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After all of the honorable things he's done, he gets shot in the back.
Hey, that the 70s, baby. Yeah. All right. It's as Brad Easton Ellis would say, the 70s.
It's just
in the 70s, if you're Stacy Keach killed at the end of the New Centurions, or Robert Blake killed at the end of Electric Light and Blue, or Captain America and Billy killed at the end of Easy Rider. It's like, no, the more meaningless the death, the better.
Yeah.
Does his friend who gives him the money to like go get a doctor, has he betrayed him?
Like, well, you mean to the blacksmith?
Yeah, to the blacksmith.
Well, he is hanging out in that town a lot. However, I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
I don't like to believe that because, I don't know, I just like Harry Dean Stanton. And also, I like the fact that these guys were childhood friends.
Yeah.
And if he had a problem with them, he
And also, he warned him, like, don't come back to town.
Yeah, he said
don't
come back
to town.
Yeah.
He did warn him.
Yeah, but I don't think he betrayed him, but Harry Dean Stanton makes it very clear, I have to live in this town.
Yeah. Like, you can't just come in and ruin my life for me because they'll come and get me too.
Yeah,
so. But yeah.
And he doesn't fight. And he doesn't fight for him. When he, but boy, I thought that was very believable. He doesn't. He's like, oh, I'm going to get revenge. No. He shouldn't have come back.
No, he shouldn't have come back. Especially because, yes, they were friends in childhood. But something has happened where Billy has run out on him. So it's like they do have a little bit of a contentious relationship. So he wouldn't.
But it does sound like they get over it.
They got over it.
I feel like they get over it.
Yeah. They got over it, but like they wouldn't stand up for him.
There is that nice moment, though, where like, you know, he's pissed at him for shooting the blacksmith. He's like, okay. Just get the fuck out of here. Just get the fuck out of here. And then so he
could fuck up the whole town.
Yeah.
Have the blacksmith, suddenly horses can't get their shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't get anything.
Yeah.
You know, and then the next
blacksmith is like 200 miles away.
Then the cavalry's going to come back and they're going to be asking a bunch of questions and they're going to look to me because I'm the one, I was the one seen talking to you.
Yeah.
But then after he's like, get the fuck out of here. Then he gives him some money.
Yeah.
All right. And then that little smile on Cliff Pott's face, on Billy's face, when Harry Dean, he was like, oh, okay, you're talking shit, but you still care for me. Yeah, it's a really nice moment.
It is.
Yeah. There's also like that, the one vignette where he's like taming the second horse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's an awesome scene.
That's an actor, and I was talking about actors back then who knew more how to handle horses,
right on.
Like, because there was still...
They were coming out of a TV culture. Yeah, they had to be on the Virginian every week, and they had to be on Laredo
you
every
look
week.
At Cliff Potts handling that horse. He is breaking that horse.
You guys, if you guys have not seen this movie, you have to understand he gets this horse that's supposed to be a wild horse. He lassos it on like a cliffside, ties it to a tree.
Which, by the way, looks absolutely dangerous scene to stage.
Yeah. Ties it to a tree and then Social like walks up with the horse and then she's watching him and he jumps on the horse and this horse is like bucking and like
I don't think there's
braying.
Any hidden wires on that horse. Yeah. I gotta
he
be
is
honest.
Breaking that horse in and it is
well he has
crazy.
A rope he has a rope
he has
bit.
A rope,
that's
a rope
right,
bit
that's right that's
him.
Right he gets the rope around it
but that's crazy that's the actor actually doing that
no yeah yeah absolutely so, yeah. Yeah probably
wow
yeah
I mean I, like
he's it, a strong looking might, guy he's
I mean,
he's
not,
a
it's probably not really like a wild horse in reality
I mean Cliff Potts is like a beefcake I mean he's like a tough guy
yeah
he's a strapping guy
yeah it's like a yeah, it's not a completely wild horse, but it's a horse that knows how to buck on command.
Yes, yeah. I mean, yeah. Still, the fact that he's able to get on a trained horse and ride it as
and
it's
have it whip around and kick him up in the air and
like
everything.
Like a rodeo.
I mean, I'd have been thrown off that thing, so.
Yeah, I would have, too. they just rape her repeatedly after she's trying to get away, and she's in the water, and she's, like, crawling because Billy has just been, like, beat up really bad.
No,
he even gets shot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's bordering on Last House on the Left.
Completely.
All right, you know, and it even kind of looks a bit like that Last House on the Left.
Yeah, when she realizes like Billy's not getting up, like he's been beat up,
shot.
He's been repeatedly
tied to
he's been shot and he gets tied to a tree, mm-hmm. and she's like in the water crawling, and they're like, oh, like let's just like go clean her up and like let's take her. No. We haven't had any time off recently. Let's all go rape her in procession. And, oh, because I'm the higher ranking officer, I go first.
Yeah.
And it's just like the worst thing ever. They're brutal with her. But you know what? Little Sparrow is, I'm actually like getting emotional over this. She's so strong and so tough that at the end when they cut her loose, she actually goes to Billy and gets his knife out of his boot and cuts him free.
Yeah.
And then dies.
Yeah. Like, well, she kills herself.
Or she kills her. But that's what I mean, though.
Yeah.
Because she can't live with it.
Mm-hmm.
But like she's strong enough that she's able to like do that to go cut him loose. Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, after all that happens, are you on Billy's revenge tip?
Yeah. Hell yeah, I am. I was like, Little Sparrow.
Yeah.
La 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 la. They're idyllic, like living in the woods together.
Yes.
Bridging like racism is over together with each other, having a happy family, building a cabin.
Divine nature nymphs.
Yes. I was like really excited for it. And then
but how long can it last
in this sick, twisted, messed up
world of this film? Where, like, even, like, the two of them, how far can they run? There is nowhere to run.
It's actually a really great moment when she could leave him out there to starve. And then she kind of realizes, okay, look, I can't quite do that.
Yeah,
I'm not ready to starve. I'm not ready to trust this guy 100%, but I'm not going to be the cause of his death.
Yeah. I don't know. Just the connection that they had, you can clearly tell that they were in love.
It's an amazing love story. It's a tragic, terrible, amazing, wonderful love story.
Yeah. We've watched a few movies with some really iconic music. Cocaine Cowboys, Lipstick, and even a few movies that you guys haven't heard us talk about yet. However, I think the music in Cry For Me, Billy is the best we've heard so far. Let's talk all about the genius behind the original songs in this film, Michael Franks. Okay, now I have to talk about the music of the movie.
Uh-huh.
I think these two original songs, Little Sparrow and Ballad of Billy, are potentially my favorite original music that we have actually come across so far on the show.
Wow.
I was actually listening to it before we came here today because I cannot get it out of my head. Okay. The music is by a man named Michael Franks.
Mm-hmm.
You can check him out at michaelfranks.com. He's been making music since 1973. He still is making music. He's apparently a leader of what's called the Quiet Storm Movement, which is a radio format, smooth romantic jazz-influenced ballady songs.
Okay.
He supports the Hearts United for Animals National No Kill Shelter. Uh-huh. So that gets a shout-out from me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But,
so far, so good.
He's worked with artists such as Patty Austin and Art Garfunkel, and then his music has been recorded by people like Gordon Haskell, Shirley Bassey, The Carpenters, Patti LaBelle, Ringo Starr.
Shirley Bassey, there's a Moonraker, a Moonraker connection we can talk about.
But basically, this guy has done so much music. I love the music in this movie. I'm actually going to buy his record called Previously Unavailable, which includes the song Little Sparrow.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, really?
I found it on eBay. If anyone likes the music in this movie, you guys should check out. It's called Previously Unavailable. It's on eBay. There's lots of records of it.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. And at the very end, the end credits one is Ballad of Billy.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they're like, they kind of show he's died, but now he's like, and I love it because it just basically tells the story of Billy before the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The lyrics, it says like Billy, he was like the fastest gun in the West. But when he got tired of killing, he left.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
that's exactly where we begin the movie.
So it tells his ballad. And I love that touch to drop back to the end. But then in the song, it's like, but now, like, Billy's time is gone, and he's with his little sparrow.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it's like, so they're up in heaven together. And so I really thought it was, like, a really beautiful way to end the movie with this romantic song. So Well, look, I love this. I love the music in this movie.
Well, I'm also kind of I think it's a little cheesy, but I'm also kind of a fan of the early 70s Western thing where they get a singer-songwriter, you know, a folk-songy singer-songwriter to do a song score. And a good example of that, and it's like my favorite thing about the movie, because I don't really care about the movie that much, is I love the music that's in The Ballad of Cable Hogue.
Yeah.
And actually one of my favorite, absolutely one of my favorite Peckinpah sequences is the Butterfly Mornings duet that Jason Robards and Cilla Stevens do together right in mid-movie. But before that, it's this other guy, you know, and he sings the song open the opening credits, and it's really good. I you know, it's very much of its time,
yeah.
But I like it.
But you know what's funny, though, is I love when movies have, like, theme songs. Like, even with exploitation films like Coffee.
Yeah.
Coffee has, like, one of the best
theme songs. Coffee is the color.
Has, like, one of the best theme songs.
I love the fact that you guys just suddenly started singing that
in stereo.
And it was like, one is, like, a baritone, and the other one is, like, a...
I love it when movies have, like, theme songs, and I can't stop humming it, like, Little Sparrow, la 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 la. I love it. So if anyone Michael Franks, michaelfranks.com,
that name sounds familiar.
Yeah,
I gotta say, it sounds familiar.
He's made a lot of music, and so if anyone wants to listen to Little Sparrow on vinyl, it's on Previously Unavailable, that's the record name, and you can find it on eBay. My vinyl cost me $9.75, and it was worth every single penny. We loved Cry For Me, Billy, but it wasn't without its faults. Quentin reveals what he wishes was different upon rewatch, along with some other William Graham films that fans should check out. And I really recommend everyone out there, honestly, after watching this, get the VHS. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Like, come on. It was only $20. You can get the VHS tape of this. You can watch this. Watch it. It's okay. So good.
Watching it the second time with Roger, I only had one misgiving.
Okay.
About it, because the first time watching the movie, you know, I bought into the whole 1971-72 aspect of it all, and the whole hippie Western and the whole anti-American, anti-establishment aspect of it all. And it's soul crushing when the soldiers show up.
Yeah. And he runs for his gun and he can't get it. And he has to defend her.
And then the killing the horse is just so fucked up.
Yeah, it's horrible.
And then everything that happens is like, oh God, I can't wait for this guy to fucking kill these guys. And, so the first time I watched it, when he tracks them all down and then wipes them out, I was just, you know, I was just into the vengeance tip of it all. It was interesting watching it the second time. The thing that I didn't like, is I thought was bullshitty, was he gets the drop on them. He completely has the drop. They're all in a fucking hole, all right? It's almost like another
metaphor
reference. All right, they're all in a hole. And if anyone deserves to be wiped out, it's them. He does a bullshit thing of he puts his gun in his holster.
I'm going to make it fair.
Yeah, I'll make it fair. Fuck that shit. These guys don't deserve that crap.
It's
all right?
Not realistic, but it's a movie.
Yeah.
But you know what, though? It's true.
I would have rather you, like, just kill them all with a Winchester.
I would have also rather have that, but it's true to his character.
Yeah.
He's the guy that is always making it fair. He's the guy that always has a conscience.
He wants it to be fair so that he can blow them all away.
But yeah, anyone who's a fan of Westerns, please track down this movie.
But especially 70s Westerns.
Especially 70s Westerns. This movie is beautiful. The VHS is really beautiful for it.
It really was.
It really is. Just please do yourself a favor. Find it.
And by the way, when it comes to Billy Graham, William A. Graham, as he's always listed, feel free to watch any of his TV movies. They're almost always good. He's a really one of the tip top.
Do you have a favorite, Quentin?
I do, because I'm such a Michael Parks fan. I don't care for the second half of the movie, but his movie Escape from Bogan County with Jacqueline Smith and Michael Parks, the first half of it is terrific. I don't care for the second half because Michael Parks kind of disappears a little bit, but it's one of my favorite Michael Parks things that he did in the 70s. Is like, especially
you love Michael Parks.
Yeah, so the middle section. The middle,
some potent TV movie there.
Yeah, the middle section is great. And Michael Parks even gets to sing in it, and he was such a great singer. And it was, I'm a big fan of that one. But I also like his other theatrical Western that I'm pointing at right now in our Western section, Harry Tracy Desperado, starring Bruce Dern.
than the early 80s.
Oh, God, I would love to see that.
Yeah.
Want more Cliff Potts? Check out these recommendations from Quentin, along with a personal story about Michael Madsen.
I can say a lot about Cliff Potts. Okay, so we haven't watched is the Dan Curtis Western starring Cliff Potts called The Last Ride of the Dalton Gang.
Right.
That also has Jack Palance, which is
Randy Quaid.
Randy Quaid.
Very crazy Randy
Bo
Quaid.
Bo Hopkins, yeah. One of my favorite Western icons of that time. But also, I first know who Cliff Potts is from... I was always a big fan when I was a kid of this movie called The Ground Star Conspiracy, which starred George Papard and Michael Sarrazin. Mm-hmm. And Cliff Potts, I always remembered he's got a part in that. And I always remembered him from that. And I always remembered his name on the poster. And so then as time would go on in the 70s, like, you know, I would see in the TV guide, oh, Cliff Potts, that guy from the ground. To me, he was always the guy from Ground Star Conspiracy. but I really liked, as I mentioned in the earlier show, is he did a pilot that wasn't picked up, but it was a TV movie sequel to Nevada Smith, mm-hmm. where he played Nevada Smith and Lauren Green played the Brian Keith character in it. And it's a really good sequel. But I've always liked Cliff Potts. As a matter of fact, I kind of got into him again after seeing Ride With Me, Billy. Mm-hmm. I went on looking on his credits, and I noticed that he played Michael Madsen had a really terrific show at the end of the 90s or early 2000s called Vengeance Unlimited. Mm-hmm. There was almost like a it was a great show. It was terrific. It was like a Columbo show where they set up the bad guy or bad woman that really dastardly. They do the whole opening 10 minutes is just how awful they are and what they've done to screw up some person. And then that person goes and hires Michael Madsen, whose job is to get vengeance. Now, he doesn't just go and kill them, but he's pretty much a sociopath in every other way. But, you know, this whole thing is always to just, you know, just make their life a living hell and get them to pay for their crimes. So all the guest stars, you know, are like a Columbo episode. You know, it's like the guy you want to see Michael Madsen, Mr. Chapel, bring down. And so, like, it's Greg Henry, you know, or it's this guy or it's that guy. Well, there's one episode with Cliff Potts.
Oh.
So I wrote Michael Madsen, hey, what was it like working with Cliff Potts? And he had to be jarred in a memory about who he was. All right. But then he was like, I like that guy. The guy was pretty cool. Yeah, he was very humble. He was a good guy. I liked working with him.
Before I close up the shop today, a few months after this conversation, I surprised Quentin with a gift I knew he'd appreciate.
Okay, so we watched Cry For Me, Billy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Cliff Potts is in it.
And we love Cry For Me, Billy.
And we love Cry For Me, Billy. And we love Cliff Potts. Mm-hmm. And then you brought Nevada Smith.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to find this Nevada Smith VHS, mm-hmm. but I can't find it. Mm-hmm. But I found something else for you. Uh-huh. So I want you to close your eyes.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And I'm going to...
Ta-da.
Oh, my God.
So, here you go, Quentin. I couldn't find it on VHS, but this is for you.
Holy shit. Is this what I think it is?
Yep.
A Nevada Smith 16 print?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Happy birthday, Christmas.
This is for you.
Oh, where did you find this?
I put my feelers out, and I had a friend, and they found it on eBay for me.
Oh,
and
wow.
I hope it's what it says it is. I think it is, but this is for you.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So I just couldn't help it, but there you go.
This shows the lengths that Gala is willing to go to meet the demands, the high bar that you set. In getting something.
Okay, no. So now I think we definitely need to have our... since we got into Cliff Potts watching a Western, Cry For Me, Billy, all right, we definitely need to do our Cliff Potts double feature, which is The Last Ride of the Dalton Gang,
yes.
All right, directed by Dan Curtis.
Yeah.
All right, which also has Jack Palance in it, but he's the star, Cliff Potts. And then Nevada Smith Part 2.
Yeah. Right there.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
So, and I hope you invite me to watch it with you.
Of course I will. Yeah. Of course I will.
Because I got really into Nevada Smith after you brought the Cliff Potts thing, because like I started...
Did you see the first one yet?
So yeah, so I watched The Carpetbaggers, actually.
Uh-huh. Oh, you did? Oh, so, yeah. Okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
Which is like the book that Nevada Smith is based on, and they turn it into a movie. And then I watched The Nevada Smith, and I really
okay.
Liked
so you it. Realize now, you realize that
the whole connection.
That, yeah, but you realize that like George Peppard is Brian Keefe's son.
Yes.
Okay.
It's all, but also I love it because it's like Nevada Smith is played by Alan Ladd. He's played by Steve McQueen, and he's played by Cliff Potts, and then Jonas Cord is played by Leif Erikson, mm-hmm. Brian Keith, and Lorne Greene. Yeah. Like there's this whole history of it.
And is you know, and the screenplay is written by the same guy in all three of them, John Michael Hayes. Yeah.
Oh, really? John Michael Hayes wrote all of them.
He wrote all of them, and it's Gordon Douglas, who I'm a big fan of. It's his only TV movie.
So there we go.
That is a find. That is a find. That's great. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, me too. That's great.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for tuning into the Video Archives After Show. Have a burning question that you want the answers to? Make sure to write in for a chance to have your question featured on an upcoming episode. Next week, join Quentin and Roger as they discuss three new films. Want to know ahead of time what we're watching? Here's a riddle for all of you loyal fans out there. Try and figure it out. The first film is directed by a Video Archives favorite and directly inspired the TV show Starsky and Hutch. The second film is about teenagers trying to lose their virginity 20 years before American Pie. And the third is an erotic thriller featuring the star of the Emmanuel series. Mama's Little Joy Boy Loves VHS, VHS, Mama's Little Joy Boy Loves VHS.
Gala, we're still recording the after show.
Oops, I didn't know anyone was listening. Well, I'm your Amy Thanatogenos wannabe, Gala Avery, signing out for today. See you next time on the Video Archives After Show.